Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software.
Today on the program, we're going to hear from a couple South Florida mayors. One is going to talk about Venezuela, the other about her legacy. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Doral Mayor Juan Carlos Bermudez is preparing for the arrival of Vice President Mike Pence. Pence will meet with members of the Venezuelan community tomorrow. Bermudez will share his thoughts on what might happen to that country. Also, we're going to hear from West Palm Beach Mayor Jerry Mullo about her 8 years in office and her legacy. And on the program, we're going to talk with folks from the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. They'll offer some answers for felons who want to register to vote. Finally, it's time for another Live from the 305. Today, we highlight the folk acoustic duo Dracula, a group making waves in the independent scene. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Vice President Mike Pence is visiting with the Venezuelan community in Doral tomorrow. Also expected to attend are Governor Ron DeSantis, Senator Rick Scott, and Senator Marco Rubio. Protests continue in Venezuela against Nicolas Maduro and in support of interim President Juan Guaido, who also has the support of President Trump. Now, earlier today, we spoke with Doral Mayor Juan Carlos Bermudez about the VP's trip to his city, as well as what he's hearing from the Venezuelan diaspora in Doral.
The Venezuelan community in Doral has been very optimistic of a change occurring. And the fact that after 20 years, you may finally have a change from government that has been in power for the last 20 years, beginning with Chavez. And I think that they're, number one, optimistic there is change, and number two, curious as to what will come next. So I think that's really where I feel most people have been at. Remember, a lot of these people have different point of views as to what should happen next, but they are very optimistic about what's happening now.
Do you believe that there's going to be change?
You know, it's interesting because I do think that there will be some change based on the fact that Maduro, I don't think, can survive, or his government will be. It'll be very difficult to survive for three different reasons, which is a little bit different, for example, than the dictatorship in Cuba. Number one is you have technology is much more accessible in Venezuela today than it is in most other places, including a place like Cuba. I think the second thing is you have the support of some Latin American countries and other countries, even though it's divided. You know, the OAS support for change in Venezuela is also. And number three is very important. And number three, I think, is it's just the economics. But when you have even people that supported the Chavez and Maduro regime unhappy about the reality where they're at, I'm optimistic there will be a change. Now, how that change will happen may not satisfy everybody's point of view if they're Venezuelan, because I think I would not be surprised that Maduro gets on a plane and takes off to Russia, China, Cuba, one of these places.
Tomorrow you have Vice President Mike Pence coming to Doral. Where's he going to be, and who is he planning to talk to during his visit?
Going to be at a church in Doral. I believe it's called the Jesus Worship Church, a little bit off 87th Avenue. It's about 90th and 15th. I still don't know exactly who he's going to talk to. Last time he came and had a meeting with leaders in the Venezuelan community, I presume that may be what his intent is this time. We're still waiting for the finalization of plans from, obviously, not only the White House, but also the Secret Service.
Are you going to be in attendance?
I will probably be in attendance to welcome him like we did last time, and certainly we welcome him to the city of Doral. He's been here. The vice president has been here a number of times, not only for this particular the Venezuelan issue, but he's come to the Southern Command on different occasions.
You have the vice president coming tomorrow. Whenever you have a president or vice president coming, obviously that's a lot of security and traffic issues, et cetera. What should people know about what's happening tomorrow and how to prepare?
Well, I would tell them if you're anywhere near 87th Avenue and about 15th, if you're, you know, the area right there, right off the 836, anytime before noon or 1 o'clock, I try to avoid it because there's going to be substantial traffic. The 836 will probably be shut down for a while. Either go to work very early or go to work late, or maybe don't go to work at all if you're in that area.
We've seen Venezuelans just trying to escape Venezuela, trying to escape the Maduro regime and go anywhere. And, of course, people are coming here to South Florida. Is this comparable to any of the other mass migrations we've seen from Latin America or the Caribbean over the decades?
Well, you know, I think it is comparable to a certain extent from the perspective of some of the things we've seen in Nicaragua and Cuba, except I think it's much more massive because of the economic, such a quick economic downturn and such pilfering of, the, let's call it the money in Venezuela. I mean, what we see here in South Florida, and I'm not talking only about Doral, because even though we had an event in Doral last week, the vast majority of those people were from Broward, from Kendall, from other places. It's a little bit unique because you've had people moving money who were once with the regime and moving them in massive amounts. It's no great secret that the administration understands that, and that's a little bit different than what you probably saw in Nicaragua or Cuba, for example. And at the same time, in the last couple of years, I think you've seen certainly a more massive flow of Venezuelans that are very different from the first wave that might have come in the early 2000s. So I guess the answer would be it's similar in some instances, but different in another way.
I'm speaking with Juan Carlos Bermudez, the mayor of the city of Doral. Vice President Mike Pence is traveling to Doral tomorrow to speak with leaders in the Venezuelan community. The United States has backed interim president Juan Guaido as protests continue in the streets against the Nicolas Maduro regime. I wondered if you'd heard from any business owners, Venezuelan business owners, who have in the past done business with Venezuela, where the state government, the federal government, is trying to tighten up on, you know, doing any business with Venezuela. But I don't know if you've heard of any business owners in Doral who have ties back home and how this is impacting them.
Yeah, I have. And, you know, some of them have had a lot of difficulty. The money exchange, the getting the materials in and out. Others, not so much. I think a lot of it depends on how many people they know in Venezuela that are still probably in positions of power. I can tell you that in the logistics industry, some people have been very, very, very impacted to the point they're no longer in that industry, even though they might have been in that industry for 10, 15 years.
And I'm curious as to, you know, what kind of businesses?
Look, there's two things. The logistics industry is the one that I have seen the most. There is no secret that a lot of people are trying to get their money out of Venezuela, so practically any business that can get them some sort of visa is one that some of them have looked into. Really, across the board, it's a hodgepodge of different businesses that that Venezuelans have sought to open, not only in Doral, but all over South Florida. Truthfully, it has had a positive and a negative economic impact, just because it's positive that some of these people are able to move their money to a place where they can actually create jobs and have businesses. It's also a little bit negative because the market's been a little bit skewed. And I think it's not just a Doral issue. It's also a Weston issue, a City of Miami issue, where sometimes there's been, businesses purchased for more than what they are actually worth, and that'll drive up the cost per square foot in adjacent areas. So that, by the way, is not just a Venezuelan issue. It's something that Miami is facing now, Miami-Dade County. And yes, I had an opportunity to talk to in a roundtable with some other political leaders and people from Florida, the editor of Florida Trend magazine and publisher. It's a Miami issue. You know, some of these dollars, whether they come from Russia or Venezuela or Brazil, when the money spent is a little bit skewed, it has impact on adjacent properties, and that leads to some of the issues we're facing today on the real estate side, both in the commercial and the residential side, as far as cost of living is concerned.
Let me finish with this real briefly, because you said a moment ago that change is coming. And so we see a lot of Venezuelans who've made their way to South Florida, but we've also heard a lot of people who want to go back home. Do you think that at any point soon people might be able to start going back home, and what impact would that have on the city?
You know, that's a great question. The first part of it is the impact. I think there are people that will go back, even if they don't know definitively what will be next or who will be the next government in power after what we hope would be democratic elections. I think there will be people who will watch and wait. You know, I've had friends who tell me, well, you know, I'm so supportive, Venezuelan friends who told me I'm supportive of this, but let's see what happens a year after, then I'll see what I'm going to do. I've had others tell me, you know, I want to go back and, you know, I want to keep my business here, but I want to get my business back there. And you know, there are others that say, you know, it's great, but, you know, my kids have grown up here. And I think, it'd be great to have a home in Isla Margarita or somewhere. So that's the answer to the first part of the question. I think it's not as black and white as we may assume that everybody will just say, I'd like to go back. I think there's still a watch and wait process that's going to take place. As far as the city, I'm not sure the impact will be. I'm sure we'll have maybe some people that will move back, and that is possible. I think some will keep their properties and businesses here. I think most will keep their businesses here on the business side. The city has had, ironically, in the last probably 2 to 3 years, just because of the market value of a lot of our properties in the last, I'd say 2 to 3, 4 years, we've had a much greater growth with other communities, whether it's the Brazilian community, the Colombian community, or even people from other parts of Dade County and South Florida. So our trends are not necessarily going up in numbers of Venezuelans coming to Doral just because of the cost of living. It's really going in the other direction.
We've been talking with Doral Mayor Juan Carlos Bermudez. Mayor Bermudez, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
And you can keep up with all that's happening in Venezuela and within the Venezuelan community at our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, felons who want to register to vote still have questions about whether or not they're allowed. Also, what constitutes a hate crime? That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, as questions remain about the implementation of Amendment 4, many felons are seeking resources about how they can register to vote for upcoming elections in the state of Florida. There are also concerns about the ability of felons to be registered if their sentence hasn't been fully completed. Also, the state attorney's office is now investigating a possible hate crime for the incident that happened on Martin Luther King Day last week. 51-year-old Mark Bartlett was captured on video using racist language and waving a gun at protesters in Brickell. He was arrested and charged with carrying a concealed weapon. We're joined now by David Mayer, Director of Community Outreach for the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. Mr. Mayer, thank you so much for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Lewis.
Let's start with this. First, help us understand, because I want to talk about this particular issue that happened in Brickell. And there was a call out for basically this was a hate crime. What people are asking is saying that this was a hate crime and we want to see punishment based on that. But help us understand what it means that you're investigating the possibility of whether the crimes could be elevated to a hate crime.
Well, first of all, I want to bring you greetings on behalf of State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle. She's disappointed she couldn't be here, but was under the weather. And I think the last person to catch that nasty bug that's going around. But she,
I've been fighting it too, so hopefully she gets better.
Greetings to you and all the listeners. So, on the incident in Brickell, I can't speak specifically to that fact pattern or case, but I can give you general information that any crime that is committed, whether it be a criminal mischief which covers graffiti, like we see horrible instances on religious institutions' doors, or a crime of violence, if the animus, the motive of the offender is to commit that while they hold a hate or prejudice towards a particular group, race, class, gender, whatever it may be, then the crime that is committed is then enhanced one degree, elevated to a higher punishment level.
And what would that mean for the sentencing?
It would be elevated. For example, a first degree misdemeanor has a maximum penalty of 364 days in Dade County Jail. If a first-degree misdemeanor crime like battery, simple battery, is enhanced with a hate crime, that would go up to a third-degree felony with a higher sentence of up to 5 years state prison.
And briefly, can you tell us what are the next steps in this case, or can you?
Well, right now there's an investigation ongoing. The state attorney has a fully staffed hate crimes unit with 24-hour on-call assistants that review, meet with victims, witnesses. And in fact, if there are any listeners on that crowded bridge that day that have any information, I can provide the phone number to call our office to put themselves in touch with an investigator.
And we'll get it from you. We'll put it up on our website for sure, definitely.
But the process is to examine all the evidence through witness testimony, any video surveillance there may be, and evaluate it in the totality of the circumstances to make a filing decision.
All right, and it's a story obviously we'll keep following. Let me transition now to Amendment 4, because this is what's getting a lot of attention since it passed in the election. What types of questions are you getting at the state attorney's office, you know, once it passed back in November? I mean, who are you hearing from? What are they asking?
Well, last Thursday, about a mile from here on 12th Street and 4th Avenue at Gibson Park, we had a huge event that the state attorney organizes every month for sealing and expunging of records. We had over 400 or 500 people show up at that event. 350 applied to see if they were eligible to seal or expunge their records. At that event, because the law is very specific that people with a conviction on their record are ineligible to have their record sealed as it stands right now, we also had a partnership with the Department of Elections for Dade County, who had a table there. So those people who were not able to seal their record, we could give them the opportunity to now register to vote by signing up with the folks from elections that were there. They had questions about if they had, whether or not they had completed their sentence, if someone was on probation or if they had served time. Obviously, they know they're no longer under supervision. We were able to give them information so they can contact the clerk's office, the clerk of the court, to know if their fines have been paid and to be able to find out if all those conditions are met. So it's not a complicated process, and we want to get the word out there to anyone who is wondering about whether they are eligible or if they're thinking on behalf of a family member to go ahead and register if they believe that they have completed all of the terms of their sentence.
And I know you've been asked this as well. We've talked about it before on air here, is the ability for felons to vote if they haven't fully paid back their debts owed to the state, which WLRN reporter Danny Rivero has explored extensively. Help us understand the requirements by felons to pay back debts owed in criminal fees to the state, how that impacts their record.
Well, there cases, there are mandatory fines and court costs that are handed down at sentencing. Those are usually tried to be handled through their probation to be paid as part of their sentence. So we're hoping that if they were up to date on all the terms of their and conditions of their probation, that they were handling that as they went along. And that's how they would be able to successfully complete probation.
And what do you say to people about the completion of a sentence? And what that means, because obviously people want to know, am I done with this? Obviously, can I now move forward?
Well, we as the state attorney's office have limited resources and information at our in the field, so to speak, when we are out in the community at various locations to be able to tell someone. But most of the time, people know, really, if they've completed it. And I think that all the emphasis that there has been on are you aware of you've done X, Y, and Z, maybe more of creating some sort of false mystery about it as opposed to, well, you successfully completed probation, you're off probation, it was terminated, so good chance is you handled everything.
I'm talking with David Mayer, Director of Community Outreach for the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office, and we're looking at a number of the key issues with Amendment 4 and the opportunities for those to have their arrest records cleared. The questions about whether or not they can register to vote. Let's come back to the sealing or expunging of your records. Explain how that works exactly.
Well, it is a Florida law. Statute 943 has been in place for decades that allows someone who has been arrested, has had a court case, or if the case was dismissed before court, to use that statute to apply to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, who is the keeper of all the police records for the state of Florida, to have a record sealed or expunged. The state attorney, over 15 years ago, keeping track of the numbers, saw that she has staff that was handling petitions that would come in where people would be asking us to sign off on the petition to seal or expunge. And she's looking at the numbers and thinking, well, there are all these cases that we have, thousands of cases in our caseload, but there's this only small number of petitions that are coming in for seal or expunge. There's got to be more people. Obviously, there's a motivation to seal your record. Why are the numbers so low? And it was because it was too difficult for a layperson without the funds to pay an attorney to do that work for them. to go through the whole process of sealing a record. So she started these workshops where every month around the county in different sections of the county, we appear with the partnership of the clerk of the court, the public defender's office, and allow someone to come in, fill out the paperwork, and find out if they're eligible and get everything taken care of. So if they are eligible, they leave there that day to be able to mail off their application to Tallahassee.
What's the cost?
For our services, nothing. It's totally free. They have to pay the $75 fee to Tallahassee for the processing.
If you know someone's been arrested and is trying to clear that record, how can they get involved in the program? What do you tell them?
We tell them to show up to our monthly events. It's amazing. It goes out on Facebook. When people come up to the table one after another, I say, how did you find out to come here today? And they said, oh, I saw it on a friend's Facebook page, or it was on Twitter. Someone tweeted it out. And we distribute flyers at a very grassroots level. But now people are learning to expect to find these flyers at very certain regular places. And for example, last week we were here in Overtown. Next month we'll be in Opa-locka on the 28th of February. And you can go to miamisao.com. That's the Miami State Attorney's Office, miamisao.com. And under the section Community Outreach, there's always going to be that month's flyer for where we are going to be, as well as allowing people to pre-register, and we will look up their record well in advance of the event and find out right then and there and notify them if they're eligible.
So you said the next event is Opa-locka on
February 28th.
February 28th. All right. We're going to make sure to put that up on the website, and we're going to get the number two. We'll put up on our Facebook so people can check it out. David Mayer, again, Director of Community Outreach for the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. We're going to post that up on social media at WLRN Sundial. So if you have any questions, we can get you connected. Mr. Mayer, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
All right, still to come, we're going to talk with the outgoing mayor of West Palm Beach about how the city's bounced back since the Great Recession. That's coming up next on Sundial.
Me diste tú, se marchito, me marcho, yo sé perder.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. West Palm Beach has changed a lot over the last 8 years. I mean, back in 2011, unemployment teetered between 9 and 10%. The city was still reeling from the Great Depression. And that's when Mayor Jerry Mullo took the helm to lead the city. Now, during her time in the mayor's office, the city has come back from that recession, attracted new businesses, and is attracting younger residents. But it still has its issues like any city. It's got to deal with the opioid problem. It's got to struggle with homelessness. And, of course, transportation's always a problem. Last week, Mayor Mullo gave her final State of the City address, and we started our conversation talking about how the city is trying to deal with the homeless issue.
We have this year over $4 million assigned to deal with homeless issues. We have two full-time homeless engagement teams that go out every day. One is particularly assigned to our downtown. The other one is assigned to the rest of our city. And they go out and meet with homeless people and try and get them the services they need, get them in some kind of housing, engage them in some way to get them off the streets. We also know that affordable housing is critical. So we have several affordable housing projects that have been built or are being built that we have contributed to in terms of getting them built so that we can stop homelessness.
A big part of it is the outreach. It's the engagement. And this is something you implemented as a strategy, is to partner up with an outreach team to try to cut down on the issue. But to what extent is engagement important?
It's critical, because the people who are doing the outreach are people who were formerly homeless, and they know what it's like. They know what it's like to live in the street. They know what it's like to get out of living on the street, and they can really relate with the people who are homeless. And so it's very critical that we have these outreach teams. Now, the county had an outreach team that served the whole county, but our outreach teams only serve the city of West Palm Beach. So it's a much narrower population, much smaller population.
Well, recently, the Florida Housing Coalition director led a six-week workshop where he outlined the budgetary process and looked specifically at how funding could be used more effectively to provide treatment, food, housing, and all the rest. During your time in office, what would you say to how the city has used its funds to address this problem? How has it changed over the 8 years?
Well, we're focused a lot more on affordable housing. We are using our federal and state monies to support this homeless engagement team. We also continue to have funding, and this is not state or federal funding. We have a Homeward Bound program where we help people get home if they have somebody there waiting for them. We don't just ship them out. We have a full-time police officer that's dedicated to working with the homeless. That's new, and we've been using taxpayer money for that. But our state and federal money is really used to address the affordable housing and the outreach teams.
I want to shift things just a little bit. We'll still be covering some homeless issues, but during your time, the opioid crisis erupted. Now, we did report that the number of overdose deaths have gone down significantly this past year. We actually talked to State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg about this. But in your time, I mean, how has the city of West Palm Beach dealt with this problem when it first popped up and then just blew up, and what you've been doing to try to quell this problem?
Well, we've worked very closely with the state attorney, and I'd like to congratulate him on the great work that he did to really address sober homes. And we worked with our planning department and our state and federal folks to get some better guidance regulations on sober homes and where they can be and how they can function. And I think that we now, through our work with the state's attorney's office, through our work with the state legislature, through our work with our own planning department, we've been able to better regulate those sober homes.
You know, when this problem came up, and this is a problem across the country, but when it came up, Palm Beach County really became ground zero for this problem in the state of Florida. Did you look anywhere else to see if anybody had success with this issue, especially with the issue of like sober homes as well? Because I want to get a sense of how you and other city leaders really tried to tackle this issue.
Every mayor's meeting I've gone to in national meetings, the opioid crisis was always one of the topics that was addressed. And, I think every mayor was struggling with a way to address it. There are lots of federal protections that are built in to protect people with addiction issues. That's considered a disability. So we had to be very careful about what we could do and couldn't do.
We're talking with West Palm Beach Mayor Jerry Muyo. She gave her last State of the City address last week, and she is out of office in March. She has been the mayor of West Palm Beach now for 8 years. We're talking about issues like homelessness, the opioid crisis, and her legacy. Let me turn things over now, Mayor, to your State of the City address last week. You talked about the JERI plan, J-E-R-I, Jobs, Environment, Reorganization, Integrity. These are the values you ran on. As I mentioned before, when you took over, the economy had just gone through the Great Recession and your community had been hit harder than most. Things have gotten better. Does the JERI plan still remain as important today?
Absolutely. Right now, we're very proud of the fact that we've been growing jobs at 20% over the last few years, which is higher than Miami, higher than Palm Beach County, higher than the state of Florida, and higher than some of the cities that we were compared to around the country. But that doesn't mean we stop looking to bring jobs to our city. We're continuing to address that. We work very closely with our business development board to attract businesses, particularly businesses from the tri-state area. We know with the new tax plan that folks are looking for places that might be friendlier in terms of taxes. We have a series of ads that are running in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area about West Palm Beach. And in addition to that, we know that placemaking is critically important. So people want to bring their businesses to an attractive place a place where their employees want to live. And so we continue to work on making West Palm Beach that place.
You talk about increasing jobs. I mean, when you took over, you had an unemployment rate of 9%. But you talk about bringing those businesses here, and I wondered about the kind of jobs that you brought to the area.
Yeah.
You know, and because, again, Florida being such a tourist town and such a service industry heavy place, what kind of jobs were you able to bring to the area?
You know, that's certainly part of it. But we have been very successful in attracting financial services to our city. We have the Flagler Financial District, and that has been quite successful. We have over 250 financial services businesses, close to 250 financial services business in the Flagler Financial District. We see more tech companies coming. Lockheed Martin has brought in a new division. So it's a variety of things. Of course, tourism continues to be a part of it, but we're also looking at financial services and the tech companies, as well as medical and medical services.
Let's talk about one issue that's always challenging in South Florida, transportation. How would you rate the state of transportation in West Palm Beach right now?
Oh, heck. I think that transportation is a regional issue. And until the region is ready to address it, I think we're going to be struggling for a little while. You know, we are putting together a group of people in the region to talk about what we can do in the area of mass transit. In West Palm Beach, we have a trolley system, a free trolley system, which we're planning on expanding. We have bike share throughout our city, our downtown area, and our near neighborhoods. We have car share with the Zipcar. So, you know, we've done a lot of that micro mobility stuff as well as our trolley. But to connect the Western communities, the Wellington, the Royal Palm Beach, all those people drive in every day to work in our city, and we need to be able to get them some kind of mass transit. And that has to be a countywide initiative.
One of the challenges in South Florida is trying to keep young people here, not having the brain drain, as they usually call it. But it's not just keeping them here. It's also attracting young people to the area. Now, South Florida is known a lot for its seniors and its retirement communities. But what have you done, or what do you think the next mayor should do to make this an attractive area for young people?
Well, I think we need to continue to do the things we've already started, like the bike share, like having people be able to live downtown and work downtown so that they don't have to get in their car to go to some place to work. So we need more Class A office space, you know, placemaking, continuing to make this a fun place, having activities. We put on 140 events a year. That's just the city. That doesn't count the boat show and Sunfest. And, oh, by the way, our median age is now 39. So we're seeing millennials move in here every day.
Mayor Moyo, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been great to talk to you.
All right, still to come, it's time for another Live from the 305. This time we meet the duo known as Dracula. That's next on Sundial.
Ladies, take warning how you court your men. They're like the stars.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, meet the Miami indie folk duo Dracula. Doris Bello and Ila Oviedo are behind the band's beautiful, haunting, but soothing sound. They met when they were teenagers and have been performing for over 10 years around Miami. Now, the band performs songs in 5 different languages and is making waves in the independent music scene for its covers of the iconic singer Selena. Now, the band was featured on NPR's Alt Latino and signed with the new local and independent record label called Sweat Records Records. Dracula is the latest in our Live from the 305 series, our bi-monthly conversations and music with the artists shaping our region. They have 2 upcoming performances, the Three Points Music Festival, February 15th, and on February 21st at Club Space in downtown Miami. We started our conversation by having them discuss the band's sound.
A lot of people call us goth folk.
It's more, I would say it's more like gothic than goth.
I just think that's a funny thing because we're not goth at all. Right. It's just traditional music and we sing with harmonies. And like you said, it sounds haunting and somber. So I guess they get that idea, but it's pretty much folk.
Tell me about some of the music that, you know, you grew up with that's influenced you. I mean, what was some of the stuff you remember, you know, as a child, Doris?
Definitely Julio Iglesias. My parents had all his records, and I didn't have a CD player. They had a record player. We didn't have enough money for a new CD player, so I would grab the record player, take it into my room, and I was pretty much stuck with just Julio Iglesias. So
And what about you, Eli?
Well, for me, I grew up in a pretty religious family, and my parents also played music. My father especially is a big inspiration for me. So a lot of the music I grew up around was kind of like in these really small churches that you'd find kind of hole in the wall, nothing like the like sublime Catholic structures that people are used to, but it would just be quiet guitar playing, a couple of people singing. Didn't really have any exposure to secular music until I was in my 20s or something like that.
Dracula, the name. You know, Dracula is this ominous, evil, but mysterious character. And, you know, he's preying on people. I mean, where did that idea come from and why?
It's funny. It was a pretty arbitrary thing at the time because we were both kind of like, what do we call ourselves? And we didn't really have, we're not really that good, I guess, with coming up with names. So at that time, she was reading Bram Stoker's Dracula, so it was just kind of the first thing.
It's worked out organically where the name makes sense now.
It's developed its own significance, I think, after a while, too. Just a lot of the music is really therapeutic, so sometimes how draining it can be to live through certain experiences. So I guess certain emotions, certain lacks that we have at that point then could be expressed in some abstract way through the way that, like, Dracula is a vampire.
You guys met what? You were 18 and 19 when you met?
Yeah.
We were both 19.
We were both 19.
Mm-hmm. Take me back. How did that happen? How did you guys meet?
I was working at this restaurant called Bali Cafe, and I met this guy named Edward that Doris was seeing at the time, and he and I got along really well. We started making music. Doris was around because they lived together. And then I realized that she had an incredible voice, and we slowly but surely started making stuff together.
And I mean, what was that first time you guys started performing together? And what was that like, Doris?
I just thought our voices melded perfectly. It sounds like we're one person almost, with a lot of echo.
Yeah. And when did it just become like, you know what, we have to do this more often together. We have to really, you know, pursue something here.
The very first time, probably.
Yeah,
we got a lot of good feedback, and we just, like he said, it was very therapeutic. I wanted to continue doing it just, you know, for us.
You know, I'm fascinated by this. You speak numerous languages, right?
I mean, I speak English and Spanish. Can speak some Portuguese, and I studied Italian, and Japanese was my major in college for a while. I mean,
but you guys can perform in like what, up to 5 different languages, right?
We've played
music. In English, Spanish,
French,
Japanese.
Where did that passion for language come from?
Well, I speak English and Spanish. My parents speak French. I'm learning Japanese. We like to listen to a lot of music from other places.
I don't know. For me, I think, if anything, like learning different languages, kind of going along with like a weak version of Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which like says that you have like a different worldview based off of the way that your language works. So that is just like, I don't know, something really fascinating to me to be able to think about people. Like, it's almost like an empathic exercise to kind of get to know somebody through their language.
How does it feel when you're singing songs in different languages? Does it change what you're experiencing with the song? And if so, do you have a favorite language?
I love singing in Spanish.
Yeah, I really love singing in Spanish. I think it's my favorite.
Why?
It's just...
I feel like there's more heart in it.
It flows out of me
in
this, like, completely natural way.
And I like the idea of my parents listening in and our families.
Yeah, and just having that, like, connection to, like... I mean, the whole politics of being, like, a hyphenated person, like a Latin American. Like, embracing that Latin aspect of yourself. Just, like, not forgetting it.
But you said there's more heart in Spanish.
Yeah.
What is that? How do you explain that?
I feel like I sing it with more passion.
What's the story behind Como la Flor by Tejana Icon Salina?
I think the way that the Latin American community, and even to delve into, I guess, like identity politics when people refer to like Latinx, where there's this new like modern take on the way that Latin American or hyphenated youth are looking at themselves and their identities, as complex as they might be here in the United States. Sometimes you look back and you think about things in your childhood and you think about how like Selena ended up really coming into the foreground in terms of popular music, and she was singing in Spanish.
And English.
And I think that was kind of a big connection right there. Not to mention that there's just like so much nostalgia involved in it. And then also the hint of like, I guess the melancholy that's involved in the tragedy of her death as a young person, I think just gives you a moment for pause.
I'm talking with Eli Oviedo and Doris Bello of the duo Dracula. The band was recently featured on NPR's Alt Latino and signed with a new independent record label from Sweat Records Records. The duo has been playing folk Latino in Miami for more than a decade. You can find out more, by the way, by going on our website or follow us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. So I want to listen to one of the songs that's going to be released on the forthcoming album for the band, 20 Años.
¿Qué te importa que te ame si tú no me quieres ya? El amor que ya ha pasado no se debe recordar. Fui la ilusión de tu vida un día lejano ya. Hoy represento al pasado.
So let's break this one down and explain the process for choosing this song and adapting it to your style. Tell me a little bit about that collaborative approach that you have, how you guys work together.
So not only do we choose the songs, but a lot of our family members will chime in and tell us, oh, this is a beautiful song. I love this song. Please sing it. And that one was requested by my madrina, my godmother. It's a trova song from Cuba from the 1920s by Maria Teresa Vera, and that's one of her favorite artists.
Do you ever find yourself when you're listening to any of these songs and you know, you don't want to copy what the artist has already done? You want to put your own spin on it.
Right.
How do you do that?
That, I think, for me, it happens inevitably through like our tone. Or just like our voices themselves, like the way that we'll pronounce things, or we'll add our own spin on it in terms of like the way that the harmonies work. It's like when you show a friend a record or something, saying, hey, I think you'd like this song, kind of thing. So it gives meaning not only to the source of what it is that you're bringing, but also to the way that it interacts with the audience or the person you're bringing it to.
I noticed that in the way when you guys were performing, is that, you know, sometimes I see musicians in their own little world. The two of you are looking at each other all the time.
Yes.
What is that? Why?
that's kind of why I like the duality of it. There's a lot of different things that you can say about it. It kind of makes us look like husband and wife, yin and yang.
Right, or like just like archetypes of like animus, animo, man, woman.
So you guys have played in like any group, you've played in a lot of different places, but is it true you played at the Miami City Cemetery?
We did, yeah. We worked with some friends of ours. We have a nomadic project called Spring Break, The End, and we did a tour of cemeteries, and Miami City Cemetery was one of the ones that we did. And the other one was the Pinewood Cemetery that's down south, somewhere in South Miami.
I mean, look, it goes perfect with the name and this idea, people thinking that you're a goth, but what is it about the selectiveness of the places you choose to perform in, and why? Why do those kind of places?
Romanticism, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's something...
theme.
It's like inevitably you enter into this contemplative mindset when you go into a cemetery. I also like the fact that it's a public space.
Yeah.
It's like a park, but except that there's people buried underneath.
We're pretty portable. We can play acoustically, we can be mic'd, and he only has the guitar. But we prefer to play in intimate spaces, dark intimate spaces. Again, nothing to do with the name Dracula. It just kind of... it worked out that way. When we perform, we like using a lot of flowers and candles. But yeah, we just like small, dark places.
Or places that have like naturally good acoustics, like stairwells. We've performed in a stairwell before.
Yeah. Or outside, because then we get outside noises, birds singing, the wind, like for the cemetery, trees.
Please explain to me the stairwell. I'm just trying to picture this now.
Well, we've played in a bathroom as well, too.
Oh, yeah, we've played in bathrooms also.
We'll go into a space. They'll tell us you can play anywhere. I start seeing where it'll sound best. And if the bathroom sounds best, that's where we're going to play because it has a lot of natural reverb.
You guys recently signed with Sweat Records Records, the new independent music label, and you were profiled by NPR's Alt Latino. How does... all this new attention, and progress feel for you? What's it been like?
I mean, it's nice to get a lot of congratulations and things.
It's our dream to have an LP.
Yeah, that's we're really looking forward to that.
Really...
But, as you get more attention, I mean, that's part of it is you want more attention. You want to get your music out to more people, but with more attention and more demand.
Yeah, of course, it'd be incredible for this to be our job.
Yeah.
Our dream.
Tell us more about the album that's set to be released early next year. We know that Lola Reskin of Sweat Records Records, her father played trumpet on one of the songs.
Beautifully, yeah.
Yes. Are there any other special collaborations? Tell us a little bit about the release. What can we expect?
His father.
Right. My father, Manuel Oviedo, my big inspiration, plays on one of the songs called La Cenaida, which is a traditional northern Mexican song. And so he kind of adds this like bass element to it that I've always felt like was a little bit missing from what was going on, but I'm excited about the way that ended up working out. And I guess in terms of the release itself, I don't know, we're just kind of like waiting it out and seeing what it's going to be like till then.
And it'll just bring more attention. What's next after this?
Hopefully a tour.
Yeah, we've never toured before. We've only played once in Gainesville, Florida, and one other time in Los Angeles, but we've never really left Miami.
Yeah, so, I mean, hopefully getting out of town, playing a few shows might be fun.
And that was Doris Bello and Eli Oviedo, the two members behind the Miami folk indie duo Dracula. The band was featured on NPR's Alt Latino and signed with a new local and independent record label called Sweat Records Records. Their new album is expected to be released soon. And they also have an upcoming performance on February 21st at Club Space in downtown Miami. You can find out more about the band at WLRN.org. Now, before we end our show today, I have an update on a conversation we had earlier this week with Commissioner Michelle Lazaro of Hallandale Beach. She joined us to discuss the controversy facing Commissioner Annabelle Lima Taub for comments that she made on Facebook about Congresswoman Rashid Tlaib. Now, the comments have gathered international attention for their severity. The Post said the Muslim congresswoman might, quote, blow up Capitol Hill, end quote. Now, we invited Commissioner Lima Taub onto our program today to respond to the criticisms by Commissioner Lazaro. She was unable to attend today, but sent us a written statement. Here's an edited portion of the statement. My comments about Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, were made in a metaphoric manner, not based on her being a Muslim, but rather on her affiliations, allegiances, and interviews with those who are proud supporters of terrorist organizations such as Hamas and Hezbollah. I never mentioned the word Muslim or Islam in my post relating to the petition that I signed. I don't have hate or phobias of any religious or cultural group, end quote. You can find more information on the Hallandale Beach Commission and more coverage on our website, WLRN.org. That's our program Sundial for this Thursday, January 31st. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Thank you again for listening. We're going to be listening to a little bit of Dracula as we end here. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.